Boy Scouts of America are a well-known organization. Many of these kids are known and would be recognized as loyal, brave, trustworthy, and kind. Many of these kids also hope to one day achieve the rank of Eagle Scout. This is the highest rank that a scout can achieve, and it's no easy task. In fact, it's been shown that only around 4% of scouts have ever reached the Eagle Scout level since the establishment of the Boy Scouts of America. One of these few people who earned the title, though, was nothing of a model scout at all. His name was John Jubert, and he was a master of tricking all those around him. He achieved the highest rank for the Boy Scout, but it wouldn't be till later that he would be more recognized for his true crimes. Hi, I'm Gavin Onchondo, and we're back on Case Files today. We're looking at different aspects of the case of John Jubert. We'll look at how forensics were able to use fiber analysis to closely inspect different ropes that he used and finally tie him to all the crimes that were committed throughout Nebraska and Maine. Starting off looking at his early years, John Jubert was born July 2nd, 1963 in Lawrence, Massachusetts. He was the oldest of two children from Joseph and Beverly Jubert. He had one sister named Jane who was born in 1965, just 2 years after him. His home life was unhappy. When he was only 6 years old, his parents split and his father left them. His mother was an abusive and controlling woman who didn't want her son to make friends with the other children. She was quick to anger and tried to humiliate her son by physically abusing him. As a result, Jubert, of course, had very few friends. School was also a miserable place as he was bullied for his size. For the most part, he would keep to himself. He did have an above-average IQ and excelled in his classes. The family would eventually move to Portland, Oakdale, when Jubert was only 11, and to earn some of his money, he began a paper round. During the summer, he also would manage to pick up a few odd jobs. With this money, he paid much of his tuition in order to go to Shivers High School, Portland's all-boys Catholic secondary school. Jubert's anger towards those around him continued to grow as a result of years of bullying at school and humiliation from his own mother. It would grow significantly after he entered high school. He concealed it well, however, coming across to the normal person as just a boy who enjoyed getting lost in books. At the time, he also became highly invested in the Boy Scouts, hoping to one day achieve the highest rank of an Eagle Scout. While all this was going on, in December of 1979, the first in a series of random violent attacks occurred in Oakdale. The first one was when 6-year-old Sarah Cantney was playing in her front yard and a young man rode by on a bicycle and stabbed her with a pencil. She cried out to alert her parents, but by the time they showed up, the man who had stabbed her was gone without a trace. About 6 weeks later, in January of 1980, 27-year-old Vicky Goff was walking down Deering Avenue towards the University of Southern Maine. A young man grabbed her from behind and proceeded to stab her in the side with a knife. He covered her mouth with his hand to stop her from alerting those around, and before she could get a look at him, once again, the man was gone. In March of 1980, 9-year-old Michael Witham was walking on Deering Avenue, the same as Vicky, when a young man on a bicycle lured him into a wooded area and began asking him a series of personal questions. Michael answered the questions and the man told him he could go, but once he turned away, the man grabbed him from behind and sliced open his throat. Miraculously, Michael got away. He needed a procedure done instantly, but he only managed to have 12 stitches to close up his wound. The attack easily could have been the end of his life, doctors informed him. He was extremely lucky to be alive. While these remained unsolved, it wouldn't be until later, when Jubert had been caught for his more sinister crimes, that these crimes would finally be put to rest. At the time, the community only knew to fear the Oakdale Slasher. In 1981, Joubert graduated high school and became a student at Norwich University, a small private military college in Northfield, Vermont, where he studied engineering. After one semester, Joubert dropped out. And when he couldn't find a job, he enlisted in the United States Air Force. 4 months later down the road, a 19-year-old Joubert moved 1,500 miles to Bellevue, Nebraska, where he was stationed at Offutt Air Base. A suburb city just south of Omaha, Bellevue had a population of around 22,000 in 1980. Joubert trained as a radar technician there and joined a local scout troop, once again trying to bring in the trust of those around him, even going as far as becoming an assistant scout leader to one of the troops. The largest city in the U.S. state of Maine, Portland is a popular tourist destination known for its 19th century architecture, cuisine, and nightlife. The city has a highly active port, which is an important hub for fishing and commercial shipping industries. And on August 22, 1982, 11-year-old Richard Ricky Stinson left his home at 7:45 for a jog along a trail in Back Cove in North Portland. Being summertime, it was still light out, and the trail was populated with cyclists, joggers, and promenaders enjoying the last of the warm evening sun. Several people saw Ricky jogging, and there was no concern whatsoever. They also saw a young man on a bicycle riding closely behind Ricky, and at the time, thought nothing of it. When it had gotten dark outside, but Ricky still had not returned home, his parents grew concerned and called the police. It didn't take long for Mr. and Miss Stinson's worst fear to be confirmed. The following morning, a motorist discovered Ricky's body in the grassy area just off the jogging path. He had been strangled, both manually and with a ligature, it seemed. Bite marks were present on Ricky's right calf, but in an attempt to distort the dental impressions, the killer had gouged them with a knife. Such an act was completely unheard of to detectives and forensic dentists who consulted on the case. By attempting to cover his tracks, the killer had made himself more vulnerable to being caught by leaving his signature. A suspect, Joseph Anderson, was arrested for Ricky's murder, but was released as the bite mark on Ricky's leg were not a match to the dental impressions. Despite the best efforts of the Portland PD, Ricky's case went cold. More than a year later, on Sunday, September 18th, 1983, 13-year-old Danny Joe Elbury was up early for his paper round, delivering the Omaha World Herald. Danny's prized possession was his bicycle, which he used to deliver the papers. When Danny didn't return home, his parents, just like Ricky's, became concerned. The police were called in and a large-scale investigation began. Danny's bicycle, along with the mass majority of the papers, were discovered near one of the routes he usually took. His parents knew something must be wrong because Danny was highly respected by the community. He was known for his hard work and wouldn't just leave his bicycle and paper route to go enjoy time with friends. 3 days later, on September 21st, Danny's body was discovered in a grassy area just off the road near Offutt Air Force, about 4 miles from where his bicycle had been found. Danny was lying face down and had been stripped to his underwear. His wrists and ankles had been bound with rope, and he was stabbed 11 times. A shape that looked something like a star had been carved in his chest, and there were bite marks on his body, which had, like Ricky, been gouged with a knife. Less than 3 months later, on December 2nd, tragedy struck again. Another boy, 12-year-old Christopher Walden, was walking to school in Bellevue when a young man driving a tan-colored car approached him. The two had a short exchange and Christopher got in the car. That was the last time he was seen alive. 2 days later, two men out hunting peasants discovered Christopher's body in a wooded area, about 3 miles where Danny's body had been found. Like previously, he had been stabbed and been stripped down to his underwear. There were also more bite marks that had been knife gouged, just like the others. When police started connecting all these cases, they were able to pick up on different patterns. The location gave Ressler, who was the FBI profiler on the case, reason to believe that the killer was not very experienced and may not know the area very well, given that the body wasn't very concealed. The evidence from Christopher's murder gave Ressler more material to work with in creating the profile. He predicted that the killer of the two boys was likely involved in an organization or club in which he spent time with preteen and teen boys. That way, he would be able to approach them more confidently. The big kicker in this case, however, was the rope. The rope, which had been used to bind Danny's wrists and ankles, was not one detectives had ever seen before. It was sent to FBI headquarters in Washington, D.C. for examination. What made the rope so inquisitive was that the inside was composed of so many different types of fibers and over 100 different types of colored yarns. Experts were used and consulted with to agree with detectives it was not any type of rope they had ever seen. Eyewitnesses came forward and were able to try to put together a sketch of what the suspect would look like. They were able to say that he was a shorter male with dark hair and dark eyes between the age of 18 and 25. But it wasn't until January 11, 1984, that a Bellevue preschool teacher, Barbara Weaver, was going about her morning work routine of preparing for her class when her students arrived. Barbara briefly glanced out the window and saw something that struck her as suspicious. A car she had never seen before sat alone in the parking lot. When she looked closer, she saw a young man sitting in the driver's seat. To Barbara, he looked an awful lot like a young man in the composite sketch she had seen on the news that previous night. Barbara and the young man made eye contact. His stare gave her a bad feeling, and she grabbed a piece of paper and scribbled down the license plate of the number of his car. All of a sudden, the door to Barbara's classroom flew open, and the young man was in front of her, threatening her with a knife. Barbara was able to run past him, however, escaping out the door and running across the street to a nearby home. She banged on the door and told the occupant of the home about her encounter. They allowed her to use their phone to call the police. Meanwhile, the young man escaped into his car and sped away. Detectives tracked the license plate number that Barbara had written down, and it came back to a John Joubert, a radar technician for the United States Air Force who was living at Offutt Air Force Base in Bellevue. Joubert matched the profile to a T. He was a young, small, not very strong man who volunteered at a local scout troop. During a search warrant of Joubert's room on the base, investigators found several different magazines and different disturbing things that would help connect him to these cases. On searching his car, they collected head hairs, which were analyzed and discovered to be those of Danny Joe Elbury. Also found in the car was duct tape and the knife. In the glove compartment, there was a small piece of rope, the same unique kind that Danny had been bound with. While all this was going on, it would seem that Joubert had been slowly coming to a close. On January 12, 1984, Joubert was arrested and charged with the murders of Danny Joe Elbury and Christopher Walden. Joubert pled guilty to both murders and gave detectives a graphic rundown of exactly what happened. While under arrest, Joubert underwent several different types of psychic evaluations. They concluded that he was suffered with different personality disorders, which is characterized by the lack of interest in other people or in forming relationships and a desire to isolate oneself from others. He also may have come across as cold and lacking empathy. Through all this, it seems that he lacked no remorse, and they asked him if he were to be released, do you think he would do it again? Joubert thought about it before responding, and he said no, he had not learned his lesson and would likely kill again if he were given the chance. He just couldn't help himself. For that reason, he told investigators that he was glad that he got caught. Joubert would be convicted of all three murders. In Maine, a state without the death penalty, he was sentenced to life in prison. However, in Nebraska, Joubert was sentenced to death. And on July 17th of 1996, that's exactly what happened. He would be put to death and hopefully bring peace to the families of all the victims that he had tormented over the years.